And people can come in with the worst public policy, and we'll agree with it because they smile at us. Too many legislators, frankly, have given up being involved, you know, sometimes with their own bill. You know, I mean, not a good one.
Today is Tuesday, July 29th, and we're calling the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today we're having an informational hearing on human trafficking and prostitution in the state of Minnesota. I want to welcome back all the committee members who are here today. We have a couple of other members who will be joining us, including, I think, Senator Sandy Pappas and perhaps some other members who are interested. I think that this issue is of great concern to many, many members of not only the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Public Safety Committee, but to other members of the Senate. And so we sent out an invitation to the entire Senate membership, and I think that as the committee progresses, other people will be joining us. And as they come in, we'll make sure that they get acknowledged. I also want to, in addition to extending a warm welcome to all the members who have made the time to be here in the interim, I want to welcome and thank all the members of the public who are here today. The fact that this room is so full of individuals in the middle of the summer really is a testament to how critically important this issue is to all of us. And I want to thank all of you for making the time to be here. And then also I want to give obviously a special acknowledgement to all the individuals who will be providing information to the committee members today. This hearing today has been a work in progress since the end of the legislative session. And we've been working very hard not only to try to synchronize everyone's schedule, but, you know, trying to find all the well-qualified and good people out there who are at the front line doing this work to come in and give us good information. Both, I think, for the ongoing effort and work that we're doing on an everyday basis, but also perhaps in preparation and giving us some food for thought as we move towards the upcoming legislative session. So I want to thank all of you for being here, and I want to thank all the individuals who are here to give us information. And I see that Senator Scheidt has just joined us. Given that, there's Senator Pappas. We just talked about you. Well, I just talked about you.
My ears were ringing.
And Senator Pappas actually has been, obviously all of you know, a great advocate on human trafficking, you know, chief author of many, many, many of the provisions that are law today, and she actually has been a great advocate for getting this hearing done, so I'm really glad that we were able to schedule it so that she can be here. Members, any thoughts or comments? We haven't seen each other in a while. All right, well, then we'll just get the hearing started. The first speaker on our agenda is Suzanne Elwell, and Suzanne is with the Minnesota Human Trafficking Task Force with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and Suzanne will give us an overview of human trafficking in Minnesota. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and other members of the Senate. I'm happy to be here on behalf of Danette Boskovic, who was not able to attend today. I'm pinch hitting for her, and this will be her information that I'll be discussing this morning with my brief amount of time. I just wanted to warn you that the handout looks lengthy, but I will not be addressing each individual slide in great detail, so rest assured that this will go quickly. Danette is the director of the Statistical Analysis Center in the Office of Justice Programs, and her responsibility is to annually conduct a study and report to the legislature on the extent of human trafficking in Minnesota. She started this work in 2005 and had the first report in 2006. And what I'll be talking about today is a result of her third effort to study the extent of trafficking in Minnesota. But one thing to keep in mind is that there's two things that are going on at the state level, both this annual study to look at the extent of human trafficking, but also the Human Trafficking Task Force. I'm a member, but I'm also an employee of this Office of Justice Programs. But the Human Trafficking Task Force is a statutory mandated task force that started in 2006. We had our first meeting, in the fall of 2006, and many of the members of the task force are here today. It requires the commissioner, under the new the statute from 2006, it requires the commissioner to find ways to train agencies and broaden the awareness of human trafficking. And the task force itself is was created to advise the commissioner on the issue of human trafficking. Specifically, the statute requires us to analyze data collection, develop a training plan, and develop a public awareness. Develop a public awareness initiative.
Is that better?
Does that help?
Yeah.
Thank you. I apologize for that.
Can you can you pull the mic a little bit closer to you?
How's that?
Much better.
Everyone? Much better. Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out. Like I said, the Human Trafficking Task Force is an advisory body, but we want to be more than that and wanted to be a leading policy and go-to organization on this topic, including initiating and responding to legislative proposals. And one of the efforts that we've been engaged in is to be fully informed on the issue of trafficking, and also we are awaiting the results of the study being conducted by the Advocates for Human Rights on human trafficking. It's a study that was funded by Office of Justice Programs to look at the extent of human trafficking in Minnesota and do a needs assessment, and those results of that study will be done in shortly. We expect them to be released in September at the time of the Human Trafficking Conference that will be taking place at the University of St. Thomas in September, on September 23rd and 24th. And we'll be hearing more about that from the Gerald Vick Trafficking Task Force later on this morning. Danette had a big charge. The statute says specifically that the human trafficking report should include information about arrests, prosecution, victims, demographics, methods of recruitment, trafficking routes and patterns, places of origin, and methods of transportation used in trafficking. This is a lot of work done by one person with very little money. The first report had in-depth interviews, a literature review, and an online service of service providers, but the second and third report expanded the online service or survey to law enforcement and nurses. And before I go further, and again, I'm going to go quickly over the data, but I did want to point out some of the limitations of the data. First off, that we are surveying respondents, and we're depending on their recall of their experiences with trafficking, either with investigating or arresting traffickers or with serving trafficking victims. And when you depend on recall, there aren't any hard numbers necessarily. We're looking at their perceptions and recollections. The other point is that when Danette designed her study, she would introduce a definition of trafficking to the survey respondents so that all individuals responding would respond consistently. And even by doing that, she knows that individuals have different definitions of trafficking and that different ideas about what trafficking includes, and that they aren't always consistent. And as a result, we recognize that some people define trafficking differently, and that is going to affect the data. We also know that it's a hidden problem. Victims don't always self-identify as a trafficking victim. Victims are misidentified, so even though they seek services or they're involved in law enforcement action, they won't necessarily be identified as a trafficking victim. Some victims just never come forward, so we don't know about those hidden victims who are undiscovered. And there really is no centralized way to count victims of human trafficking. We don't have a standardized reporting mechanism right now. And because of this, it's very difficult to quantitatively identify the nature of human trafficking in Minnesota. Okay, slides 19 through 13 really just talk about response rates and the nature of respondents. I'm not going to go through those individually. I just wanted to point out a few things. One is that we did get a very good response from law enforcement agencies and service providers, although we do know that nurses were very underreported. So we're not quite as sure about the accuracy of the data regarding nurses, but we're very pleased with the service providers and law enforcement involvement. All types of service providers were represented. Respondents were coming from all parts of the state, and we had about half of the sheriffs represented. Sorry for the... I'm going to move ahead to slide number 14. This is probably one of the key pieces of information from the survey. The respondents were asked, have you ever worked with at least one victim of human trafficking or a victim been involved with an investigation or arrest? 47% of the service providers responded that they had. 10% of law enforcement said they had, and only 6% of the nurses. When asked if they thought it was a growing problem, 67% of the service providers said that it is a growing problem in Minnesota, 34% of law enforcement, and 18% of the nurses. One of the reasons why we might have a perception of a growing problem is that we have a growing awareness of it, but it could also be that there's better detection about what's happening out there. There's also an idea that as we have increased populations in our state, either because of economic conditions or an influx of immigrant populations, we know that victims of trafficking often come from those vulnerable populations. And as we increase that population, we have an increase in trafficking. One thing I want to note is that the increase in or the high amounts of don't knows to this question is probably just a reflection that people are not aware of it, that there's a need for training on the issue of trafficking in all these disciplines. Looking at slide number 16, this is just the question, where are we today? This is a snapshot of where we are today with whether service providers and law enforcement are dealing with victims of trafficking. They were asked if they, at the time of the survey, they had any involvement in a law enforcement action or arrest or investigation involving trafficking, or if they are currently serving any trafficking victims. And that snapshot tells us that we have 275 sex trafficking victims currently being served by service providers in Minnesota. We have 39 labor trafficking victims, and there are 29 active human trafficking investigations at the time that survey was administered. Again, looking at the slides 17 through 21 deal with labor trafficking, and slides 22 through 26 deal with sex trafficking. There's a lot of detail in there, but I'm going to go through that just skim right along and talk to you about some of the key points related to, sorry to get these points taken out. I did want to remind you as we're talking about these numbers that the numbers are small, but they still provide some interesting information. So I'm going to slide, just talk about a few of the key points related to those information about both labor and sex trafficking. First off, victim service providers are reporting that they are serving sex trafficking victims more than labor trafficking victims. 75% of those people who are serving any kind of trafficking victims, most of them are serving sex trafficking victims. Those law enforcement officers who reported having experience with investigating trafficking report experience with both types of trafficking, both human trafficking and labor trafficking. Law enforcement reports that over a third of their human trafficking and labor trafficking cases involve gangs, well over a third. And finally, the respondents who to the survey are reporting that these victims are coming from all over. They're coming from within Minnesota, they're coming from the Midwest, they're coming from other parts of the country, and they're coming from other countries themselves. And there are a couple of slides that will indicate those various areas that are being reported about where those victims are coming from. The most prevalent area where an international trafficking victim is coming from is Mexico, as well as where an international labor trafficking victim is coming from is Mexico. Again, these are preliminary findings. The report is also going to include training needs, needing and missing resources, barriers to serving victims, length of investigation, and experience with Native women and girls as victims, and you're going to be hearing more about that this morning. We're continuing to be confined, however, when we present this data, that we're continuing to be confined by uncertainties, either by the limitations of our data gathering strategies that we have available, or as a result of the nature of trafficking itself. As I said before, the definition of trafficking is not uniform, and so some people regard one type of act as trafficking, whereas another group will not regard that same act as trafficking. And that's going to provide difficulty in studying the problem when we have a broad spectrum of exploitation that occurs, and people's experiences don't fit into little boxes that everybody agrees upon. We're also relying on people's recall We don't have a standardized methodology for collecting information from either service providers or for law enforcement. It's a hidden problem. So we have the problem of victims aren't coming forward, and those victims that are coming forward might be misidentified, misclassified, or the victim still doesn't reveal that they're a victim of trafficking, and that's going to affect our ability to collect numbers. And there's a lot that we don't know. We don't know if those people who are coming from other countries were trafficked into the United States specifically for trafficking, or they came to the United States and ended up in an exploitive situation and were trafficked after they came to the United States. And finally, we have limited resources. We're limited in our ability to study this problem by the tools that we have and the resources we have available. In order to study it even further, that we need additional mechanism to gather that data and have consistency about how people collect that information. But the bottom line of this information does reveal that trafficking is occurring in Minnesota, and that many people are being harmed, and that there's a need to provide adequate services to those victims.
Thank you. I know that we were intending to build in at the end of all the presentations an opportunity for discussion, question and answer, but if you all have questions, why don't we ask questions to clarify or any information that you have on this presentation? I think that it's always easier to do that as we go along. So if you have questions, let's
Madam
do that.
Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'd like to explore a little further the definition of what we're trying to seek. It seems to me that without having defined what is sexual or sex trafficking, that we're never going to know how we get it or get there. And whether we start with that here today is not, I don't know your agenda, but it seems to me that that's a key element of what we're trying to do. We should find out what sex trafficking is, and then look at ways to correct that.
Well, Senator Foley, I hope that's part of the discussion that we'll generate today, is to get the information. And I agree with you that part of the reason why I think there's some inconsistencies in our ability to collect the information is that not only are the service providers and the public safety officials out there are not aware of what that definition is. I think that while we here have tried to work very hard to be consistent, Senator Pappas can talk about that, in terms of how we define trafficking, I think that there is an issue with educating the service providers and the public out there on what that definition is. And one of the outcomes, I hope, is that to have this conversation to help get that ball, start that ball rolling. So, Senator Pappas.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Now that I've caught my breath, I wanted to thank you for holding this hearing. I appreciate the attention of the committee on this really important issue. I did want to ask Ms. Elwell a question, and that was maybe I missed it in your report because maybe it was early on, but did you see or much change or difference between the 2006 survey and the 2000? And I don't know if there were two more surveys, 2007, 2008 surveys, where was there more identification of trafficking victims, or were there any other significant changes?
Ms. Dowell.
Ms. Boskovic will be presenting that in the report, but in general, there isn't a significant difference between either the perception of the nature of the problem or a significant increase in the numbers reported.
But it's also my understanding, Ms. Awal, that the information that was reported isn't necessarily information that is mandatorily collected at the point of service.
That's right.
So it is a survey that was sent out, and as you accurately pointed out, it's based on people's recollection. It is not base data at the front end as incidences happen. I mean, we're not recording that as it's coming in.
That's so, right. It's the best we can do with the methods that we have.
Very good. Senator Olson and then Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Elwell. You mentioned that there was perhaps some confusion about the definition of what human trafficking would be considered. And I just wonder if maybe you could tell us what definition was being used, since I have some questions myself For example, in my district, I had a school teacher a couple years ago tell me a very disturbing story about a 12-year-old girl in her classroom who was pregnant, and when they started to investigate, the family disappeared, but she later found out from this girl's friends that her mother was in a gang and had given her daughter at age 10 to the male gang members to be used sexually. And then the family disappeared, and the teacher doesn't know whatever happened to them. Would that constitute human trafficking when someone is used against their will that way?
Yes.
Or is it
under the definition that was used in the survey, and under the definition that's used by the Human Trafficking Task Force, it's coercion into or by any means. The Human Trafficking Task Force has a broad definition of trafficking that says that. I don't have it in front of you. That has the promotion or placement of someone into prostitution or sexual exploitation by any means. The definition that Danette used in her study included also the use of force, whereas the Human Trafficking Task Force doesn't use the definition to include force. But coercion, certainly at age 10, anyone, a minor, is going to be considered a victim of sexual exploitation in that situation.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Elwell, the two groups you've recognized, the sexual trafficking and the labor trafficking, do you find these groups intertwined, or are they separate entities that are promoting either labor or sex trafficking?
In terms of the traffickers?
Right.
Unfortunately, I don't have any information specifically on that. I think that since law enforcement is reporting that you have gang activity in both of them, you're looking for a profitable enterprise, and that could be labor trafficking or sex trafficking. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the information. Some of the other presenters might have that.
And Ms. Elwell, you mentioned in your last line of answers the coercive element to part of the definition that would define sexual trafficking, but how do we define the labor trafficking? Is that a coercive, or is it using people that are here illegally, or is it people that are here legally? How does the perpetrator enforce that individual to do the labor?
Coercion can be done in a variety of ways. It could be from somebody who is here and undocumented, or could be here somebody who is documented, and they take their documents and say, well, we're not going to give them back to you until you work your time off, or whatever the threat might be. And so it's not a nature of whether they're documented or undocumented. It's just a matter of coercion, what they might have over them, that they require them to pay a debt back to their family, or that they won't return property to them, or their passport to them, or their travel documents to them, unless they continue to work.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Elwell, is coercion a kind of a requirement to fit this definition?
It's part of what can be used in the trafficking definition.
All right.
Members, I've asked counsel to look at the definition in the statutes, and she's going to give that definition to us.
Madam Chair and members, basically there are a couple of places in the criminal code that define labor trafficking and sex trafficking. And I think, Senator Limmer, what you're referring to is probably in the definition of forced labor or services. And it refers to threat, either implicit or explicit, et cetera, that if the person did not perform the service, they'd suffer either bodily harm or physical restraint. Physically restraining or threatening, abuse or threatened abuse, or knowingly destroying, concealing, removing, confiscating, or possessing an actual or purported passport or other immigration document. So I think it does touch on those kinds of questions that you had.
Thank you. One other question, Ms. Elwell, does the labor trafficking, does it involve children?
Yes. If you look at the...
And I'm assuming the sex trafficking also involves children.
Yes.
So that would be a violation of not only state law but federal law as well.
The crimes that are occurring could come under both federal and state. The federal crime is going to have additional issues related to come under the federal jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Elwell, in your slide number 26, with respect to the statistics on the individuals from the different countries. And I find it interesting that under Asia, you have listed, and in some other places too, Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Do you distinguish in the statistic or in the information that's collected whether these individuals are brought over for the purpose of trafficking, or were they refugees or immigrants who are here who just happen to be of origin from those countries?
These are all international sex trafficking victims, so people who are coming into the country, but I don't have the answer for that. That's something, and I don't even know if Ms. Biskovic has the answer to that. These are people who are identified as that was their point of origin, whether they were trafficked into the United States for the purpose of, or brought into the United States for the purpose of trafficking, or they ended up here and then became trafficking victims is a piece of information we don't have.
I think it would be very good to... I haven't had a chance to look at the executive summary or the report yet, but I think it would be very good to distinguish that as you do work in the future, because we do have a large African refugee community here in Minnesota, as well as a large Asian refugee community here. And we should be careful in the information that we're collecting so that the people who are already here as refugees or immigrants who then fall into prostitution does not get mislabeled as being, you know, part of the international trafficking statistic, because these aren't necessarily internationals. These right. are Minnesotans and more likely U.S. citizens who have been trapped, I think, into prostitution. Right. I think, I mean, not necessarily that it would make a difference in terms of how we would all respond from a service perspective, but I think statistically we, in order to accurately gauge the level of international trafficking that's happening and the amount of domestic prostitution that's happening, I think we should maybe try to see if we can distinguish between that.
I think it would be a good information to have. I think the other question is does that make a distinction for how we address, detect them? How do we respond to their needs, is what kind of differences we might see right. for those two different groups of individuals.
And the final question, Ms. Alwell, what is the budget of the Human Trafficking Task Force?
I apologize. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. I know we had a budget at the beginning. That money has been used in the initial years to facilitate that task force. A facilitator was hired. Grant money was given to the Advocates for Human Rights for the study that was conducted. And I believe that the initial fund that we had has been completely depleted. And
can you provide as a follow-up that information to members of the committee?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To the members of the audience, I understand that there were not enough of these handouts to go around, so my office is making copies, and we will have them available for you to take home. And if that's still not enough for everyone, I know that one person that I didn't talk about at the beginning is Ms. Amy Brennigan, who is with the Office of the Economic Status of Women, who have been very critical to helping us pull together this hearing. And she says that, you know, if there's anything, any other information that's being provided here in terms of the study or the report or any other information that we can't get to you, please be sure to connect with her and give her your contact information, and she will help with the follow-up to make sure that you get the information that you need. Thank you, Amy. Our next speaker is Sergeant John Bannemer, and he is a sergeant with St. Paul Police Department. But more importantly, he is with the Gerald D. Vic Human Trafficking Task Force. And I have seen his presentation. He does a phenomenal job of telling us what it's like to be deeply involved in this area. It's compelling, and I am just very pleased and glad that, Sergeant, you've made the time to come and present the information to the committee. So welcome.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Muon, Senator Olson, and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here to talk about the Gerald Vic Human Trafficking Task Force. I'd like to start with a little background of how we got started in this work. Back in early 2005, Sergeant Jerry Vick was the lead investigator of the in the vice unit of the St. Paul Police Department and was investigating a prostitution ring in St. Paul that, through his investigation and his undercover work, believed involved women who were transported across international borders for the purposes of sexual exploitation and prostitution specifically. Through many steps and many months through this investigation, partnerships were developed through the civil society and the U.S. Attorney's Office, and funding was applied for through the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance. And in October of 2005, the Bureau of Justice Assistance awarded St. Paul Police Department a grant to form a human trafficking task force in the Twin Cities area. In October 2005, that initiative took place, and the Gerald D. Vick Human Trafficking Task Force was implemented. The purpose of the task force was to bring local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies together with organizations that provide comprehensive services to trafficking victims to identify and rescue victims of human trafficking both internationally and domestically, as it appeared in Minnesota. Those objectives and goals for the task force included identifying and collaborating with community stakeholders to eliminate human trafficking, facilitate a strong law enforcement role in public awareness and outreach, develop and implement training in identification of trafficking victims, increase identification of trafficking victims through proactive law enforcement, assist trafficking victims with applications of T visas, U visas, and continued presence in the United States, and identify and apprehend those engaged in human trafficking in the Twin Cities area. During the last 2 years, the task force has met the goals set forth in that original application to include the identification of 29 victims in the Twin Cities area that we encountered through investigations, and a training of over 800 law enforcement officers in the Twin Cities area. As you know, the number of immigrants and refugees in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, Ramsey and Hennepin counties, represent a third of the state's population and has grown exponentially. These new Minnesotans come primarily from Latin America, Southeast Asia, Africa, and former Soviet bloc countries. The Office of Refugee Resettlement cites prostituted persons engaged in sex entertainment, and immigrant populations generally as likely populations among which trafficking victims may be found. These populations are strongly represented in the Twin Cities and the surrounding communities, and the Twin Cities is one of 13 metropolitan areas targeted as a high-intensity trafficking area by the 2003 Innocence Loss Initiative to increase law enforcement investigation of child prostitution. The Human Trafficking Task Force specifically has provided complex trafficking training throughout the original grant period, which ends at the end of September of 2008. The targeted audience for that training was the entire St. Paul Police Department, many members of the Minneapolis Police Department, and many officers from neighboring departments through in-service trainings that they asked us to do and community college classes that we offered to outstate agencies and correctional officers in the state of Minnesota, as well as various classes and seminars that we spoke at for service providers. The task force is currently in the process of we've completed our planning process and implemented our registration process for a two-day human trafficking conference that will be provided by the task force members. The seminar will be held at the River Center in St. Paul on September 23rd and 24th. I believe I've got copies of registration form and some information that are available to the audience and members of the committee. That conference that we're planning is going to have many different areas that we want to focus on, including gangs and how they're involved in human trafficking in Minnesota. We'll have gang experts speaking about that issue. Community collaboration, what it takes to successfully identify human trafficking through the community collaboration. Victim identification, prosecution of cases both federally and locally, and then victim needs and resources once they're identified. We also have a victim speaking that is a recent labor trafficking victim from outstate that will come and speak to us about her experiences, and we look forward to hearing about that. Ongoing training also includes through the U.S. Attorney's Office for members of the task force and people that we work with, ongoing training through Washington, specifically on certain topics. We have one today that we focus on the coercion aspect of trafficking and how to better identify that and prosecute that for our law enforcement partners. The St. Paul Police Department has been invited to apply for a non-competitive supplemental funding to continue the task force work. We have done that, and hopefully that will be approved soon, and we'll continue that. In that application, some of our goals that we wanted to achieve was the further development and expansion of the task force. We're in discussions with the Duluth Police Department as well as the Moorhead and Rochester Police Departments to get them to come on board with our task force and expand this from a regional Twin Cities task force to a state law enforcement prosecutorial task force to work together. We're finding that many of our investigations are crossing into Duluth. We know that the Native American girls are being trafficked off of the reservations into cities like Duluth, port cities, or at least we have reports of that, and we want to be able to investigate that efficiently and effectively through the task force model. We want to continue to make an assessment of the local trafficking problem and its developments, and I think the state assessment through the state task force is going to go a long ways towards telling us where our energy should be focused on here in the state. A public awareness campaign designed to educate immigrant communities about human trafficking, how to recognize it, and then, of course, the ongoing training regimen focusing on the multidisciplinary approach to address the issues of victims and victim services and bringing law enforcement and service providers together. I should add that the task force currently consists of three federal law enforcement agencies, that being the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Department of Labor. There's four prosecutor's offices, the U.S. Attorney's Office, Minnesota Attorney General's Office, Ramsey County and Hennepin County Attorney's Offices, and the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, Minneapolis Police Department, and the St. Paul Police Department. We hope to expand that significantly over the next grant period and continue to do the work that needs to be done for law enforcement and service providers to educate those people out there about human trafficking and how to identify the victims so that they can be rescued. Thank you.
Any questions for the sergeant? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sergeant Bandemir, could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what the protocol is? I mean, how you approach this through the task force when someone identifies a victim?
Sergeant.
And is this the kind of thing that you're training police officers to do once they recognize the trafficking victim, if they do?
Yes, our victim protocols, when they're identified, whether they're identified through a nonprofit organization or a service provider or a law enforcement agency or even prosecutor's offices, which we've had cases referred from prosecutor's offices that through other investigations and prosecutions they've recognized some type of human trafficking and forwarded those cases on to us. Basically, our protocol would be that the case be referred or the information be referred to your agency's partner. Say if it was the a service provider in an immigrant community that thought they had a human trafficking victim, they would contact civil society, who would then do an interview process further identifying the steps and the needs for the victim and whether or not it's an investigation that needs to happen. If there was an investigation that they felt needed to happen or would like to pursue, then they would forward that on to a member of the task force, myself, or one of our law enforcement partners.
Sergeant, how many other police departments have their own human trafficking task force?
In the state of Minnesota?
Yes.
That'd be zero as far as I know.
So just the city of St. Paul?
Well, the city of St. Paul has the vice unit, and within the vice unit we have the human trafficking task force that we run. I work in the vice unit. There's an officer that works in the vice unit. We are dedicated 100% of our time towards human trafficking.
So how many of you are part of, how many officers are part of the human trafficking task force? Two?
Well, two full-time members from the St. Paul Police Department. There are two members from the Minneapolis Police Department, investigators from the Hennepin County and Ramsey County investigators.
So the way it works is that even though the task force really was an outgrowth of the St. Paul Police Department, that now the task force actually includes police officers from other jurisdictions?
Correct.
And what so officers are dedicated to working together, kind of like the gang task force. Right.
It's the same type of model except for there's no funding for for law enforcement agencies other than St. Paul to identify and, assign an investigator to work full-time on it. The investigators that are on the task force from our other law enforcement partners all have other duties within their department.
I see.
And we come together, and when cases cross into their area or cases they can help on, then we assist them with that as members of the task force. Say if there's a case in Minneapolis, we will go assist Minneapolis with that with manpower and investigative techniques, as well as they will come into St. Paul to help us on human trafficking cases.
So the grants that are being written for to really help you to do the work of the task force is housed in the St. Paul Police Department. You're full-time dedicated to this, and then what you do as part of this is you go out and train other officers in other jurisdiction on the work of the task force, and in a way they associate with you so that you guys can cross jurisdiction to do investigations?
Yeah, the only funding that is out there is given to the St. Paul Police Department, and that funds my salary, and then a matching fund that the department gives is another officer's salary and a percentage of our commander's time for administrative work. But our duties are basically to organize the task force, to investigate cases as they appear to the task force, whether they are in Bloomington or Minneapolis or St. Paul. And then we use, I should also mention, I think I forgot to mention, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension agent also was assigned full-time to work on human trafficking cases, and she is housed with the ICE office in Bloomington. We do crossover jurisdictions quite often. That's the nature of the crime, and it requires that we have partners that we can call upon in other counties, both federal and state partners, to help us because of the jurisdictional issues. The BCA officer and myself have been cross-designated as customs task force officers, which gives us a little bit more access to go across, for me, city lines, and kind of helps me to do investigations and do any enforcement activities that we need to do outside of the city of St. Paul.
Sergeant, when I heard your presentation last time, I thought you did a great job of delineating how the federal agents and the state agencies like the BCA and the local officers work together. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that for most of us, I know that there is an ICE agent or within ICE at the federal level, there are a number of people who are dedicated specifically to doing human trafficking work in Minnesota. And so we don't have anybody here who's going to talk about the federal participation in that here in Minnesota. And I wonder if you would be willing to share a little bit how you work with the federal government on trafficking cases.
The local ICE office here in Minneapolis has a trafficking unit set up which is, I believe, unique to with immigration and customs enforcement. It's unique to this geographic area. Not all offices have a trafficking unit in their jurisdiction and in their areas of responsibility. Within that trafficking unit, they have two investigators that do most of the human trafficking work, as well as the state BCA agent and myself, who are assigned to this task force within the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The whole idea of the task force is to bring together the federal and state and local law enforcement officers. These cases are complex, they're time-consuming, and they're a large drain on resources. And the federal agencies are able to assist us with a lot of those resources that we need, from overtime money to equipment purchases to manpower issues. So this work, I don't believe, and I think it's been proven out over the last three years of the task forces across the country working together, the successful task forces are those that are working together comprehensively, federal, state, local officers with service providers, to identify and then bring these cases to fruition, because it can't be done by the St. Paul Police Department alone. It can't be done by the state of Minnesota alone. We need to have that partnership there, and that's what the funding goes to for the task forces. We are one of 42 task forces in the country currently funded by the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice. The closest one to our east would be Milwaukee, and the next closest one to our west is Seattle. Wow. So there's quite a range there, and we're kind of on an island to ourselves up here in Minnesota. That is one of the reasons why we look to expand our task force, or try to expand it in the upcoming time.
Senator Foley and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sergeant Bendemeer, one of the main problems that we are facing today deals with the mix of non-resident or non-U.S. citizen, or however you define those, and then those folks that fall within the sex or labor problem area. Are people who are non-citizens given some support to get out of the way where they are?
As far as the victims that we encounter?
Yes.
Yes, there is absolutely that is in place. And I think they'll probably be talked about later in the session. But briefly, there are avenues for immigrants who are entered the country illegally or were smuggled in the country, so that if they are a victim of human trafficking, encounter through a service provider or a law enforcement person, that we can provide them with continued presence into the country, which allows them to stay in the country on a legal status to assist law enforcement with the investigation and prosecution of those traffickers. With that continued presence is housing, medical support, language transition, and many other things I'm sure will be covered later, and eventually on to what the government would like to see is a T visa, a trafficking visa, which gives them a more permanent residency in the country and gives them more benefits so that they can not become victimized again.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Sergeant, are you satisfied with the level that you're able to deal with in this situation? It seems to me that we've got Homeland Security and ICE and others working at cross purposes, and I know specifically in Minneapolis they have an ordinance that prohibits the police from dealing with the immigrants. I don't know whether St. Paul has one or not, but I do know that that there are some serious conflict resolution problems there, and I'm wondering what you thought we could do to solve that.
Well, I don't know if I can go as far as to give ideas how to solve that conflict, but I do know that in my experience working with ICE under Homeland Security, The people in the trafficking unit and the investigators that I work with are work under the Office of Investigation. They do not work under detention and removal. They don't go out and look for illegal immigrants in the country for the purposes of deporting them. We are looking for illegal immigrants who are involved in criminal activity, and that criminal activity specifically for us is human trafficking or smuggling. And for the city of St. Paul, you refer to the sanctuary city policy, and that refers, so we want the immigrant community to feel that they are able to come to us and tell us if they are a victim of a crime. We don't want them to be afraid to report crime to us. We want to take that information and move on to it, and we don't want to cause people to think that something's going to happen to them, they're going to get arrested for reporting crime. That's not what the task force is about. That's not what the city of St. Paul is about, and it's not what we would knowingly put up with. Mm-hmm. The task force is designed to identify. It's one of our major goals, to identify human trafficking victims. Most times, internationally, they could be in the country illegally. And if that is the case, we will make every effort we can to give them legal status in the country as a victim of a crime. And as we prosecute the traffickers in that case to the full extent of the law.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, Senator Foley, that is a very interesting point, and I think that there's a lot of misunderstandings about the separation ordinances that are in effect both in Minneapolis and in St. Paul. And I think that the sergeant has given a very good example of where there is a tremendous amount of collaboration, I think, in all areas of investigation between local police officers and our federal agencies that are present here. And so in terms of the collaboration, the work with ICE and our local human trafficking task forces, I think that they've done a tremendous job of collaborating and using resources to best respond to the victims in this situation. You know, the one area where I think it's not necessarily that they're working at cross purposes in terms of their investigative work, where I think there might be some confusion and we're working across purposes is in the perception. You know, very few people know that within ICE here in Minnesota, there's a very active and very, very productive human trafficking investigative unit that has worked very closely with local law enforcement. And in the and so I think that as somebody who works in the community and I want victims of trafficking to come forward to work with not only local law enforcement, but with federal agencies that are working on this issue. Sometimes I think it's a little bit chilling to think that people are going to confuse the human trafficking investigation work that ICE is doing to sort of the other removal and deportation efforts that they're doing on the other hand. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to really expend the effort to educate the community that, you know, the work that the federal agency does isn't just about removing of people who are here undocumented, but that there is an arm in ICE that works very hard on human trafficking with local law enforcement. I think very few people know that. And so the perception out there is that I think I've heard from victims is that, you know, they're a little bit suspicious to be working with someone from ICE who is doing investigation in human trafficking because there's not a trust that there is that separation, and that if people really do avail themselves to the services or the protective services that are being provided by the human trafficking arm of ICE, that somehow they would get the assistance that they need as victims of human trafficking. And so within the community, you know, we need to work to make sure people know and we don't chill the effort on behalf of the victims to come forward, to self-identify, to say, I'm a victim. I'm here. You know, maybe I was brought in illegally. I was trafficked, but I'm here, and I need some assistance. If we don't do an adequate job of making that separation happen, I think that we will have done a disservice to these victims, because they will continue to be under the misperception that all ICE is about is removing people who are here without document. Even if they're a victim, you know, they will be afraid that they might get removed, because ICE is about raids and removal of people. And so part of, you know, what's really important today is that I think you're right, we need to do a better job of talking about the federal efforts in combating human trafficking and make sure that the community understands that, so that there isn't a fear factor in the community for people not being willing to come forward to cooperate when it comes to human, how we combat human trafficking in the community. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're going to have a later speaker specifically talking about Native women, but because we have someone here from the task force and we're talking about jurisdictional issues, I wanted to ask you, I live in Bemidji, which is the largest community between the three largest Indian reservations in the state, and I'm wondering how much communication and coordination there is with law enforcement in northern Minnesota, whether would be tribal law enforcement, counties, the FBI, so that when a situation happens like the one I mentioned earlier, and if and there's been a report of something that would qualify as human trafficking happening there, and the family disappears or the person disappears and is no longer thought to be in our jurisdiction, whether there's been follow-through and follow-up reaching out either to your task force or wherever they would go, to not just let it end because they're no longer living in our area.
Sergeant?
The task force itself, we've had discussions about that topic recently. We've met with people that represent the Native American community in Minnesota, and we're researching right now what is the best way for us to get into the community much like the immigrant community, get them to trust us and be able to come to us with these types of issues, whether that's through the tribal law enforcement or through the different prosecutor's office that work on those reservations. I'm not really sure how that's going to go. That is one of our future goals as part of expanding it to get into the Native American community. Now, I'm certainly not an expert on that community, and we rely on the experts here at the state to help us do that, and I'm sure that we'll be able to at least put that option out there. And with our training coming up at the end of September, we specifically are targeting those law enforcement people for the tribal police to come to our training to at least be aware of the issue and so that they can bring it to our attention.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Sergeant, I guess what I'm wondering is, I think that's an important effort and something that needs to happen, and working with tribal governments to be able to talk about this approach to get people to trust you and identify these things is very important. But I also know that we already have some systems in place, whether it's our law enforcement systems within the county or within the tribe, even our school districts, you know, when, for example, the case I was talking about. So there are government organizations in the northern part of the state aware of these situations as they come up, in occasionally at least. And I guess I'm just wondering, are they being followed through in terms of being reported and outreached to other agencies in the state to find out what happens to these children or young women? Or is it just kind of, well, they're gone now? And I mean, at this point at least, so far, has there been any of that coordination or...
I don't have any information about any investigative tips or investigations that are occurring currently involving those communities as far as human trafficking goes. All the information that we receive is anecdotal, word-of-mouth information that you know, women are taken off by gangs, for instance, brought down to the metro area where they are prostituted. That's pretty much the extent of the information that the task force has right now. And that's part of our avenue of have opening discussions with the community leaders there to find out how do we get that information firsthand. because that's how we needed to investigate. So it's an ongoing process right now.
Well, Sergeant, thank you. And I think, Senator Olson, that's a good leeway into the next portion of our hearing. We're going to be hearing from the Executive Director of the Civil Society as well as the Native Women effort here. And so maybe we'll get some additional information on your question. I'm very interested in that. So, Sergeant, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And we might have you come back, and next time I'd like you to bring your video. So, because I thought that it was the information in the video, although it's a little bit longer and we're a little bit short on time today, follow some field officers as they investigate some of the places where women who are being trafficked are housed. And it is, you know, and sometimes you need the special training in order to even recognize that when you're busting into a place, it might make you think twice about whether or not those individuals are being trafficked. So next time you come, we'll have you bring your video. It will be very helpful. Next, we have Ms. Linda Miller, who is the Executive Director of Civil Society, to come and talk to us a little bit about victim services as well as other information. So thank you.
Where is that? Can I ask how to get this started here?
We'll get you some technical assistance.
Yay,
but you will need to pull the microphone really close to your mouth,
mm-hmm.
like you're almost swallowing it.
All right.
So that we can get the information to everyone in the room.
This one. Okay, great. No, not that one. There we go. Okay, then I'll just go. Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm again Linda Miller from Civil Society. We are part of the VIC task force in that we receive federal funds to provide the human services and the services that provide safety to the human trafficking victims that we find. And that is both the victims that civil society finds and the victims that the law enforcement personnel on the task force find. The first thing I want to say is thank you to all of you. Our author, Senator Pappas, is here, and I'm glad of that. And I remember Senator Limmer was involved in the 24-hour crisis line. That was a 3-year grant ending next June. And the other, we have 15 free legal clinics each week as a result of funding from the state. And those free clinics are in locations that are very diverse and helpful to people during the day, during the evening, and people of different ethnic organizations, languages, and religions feel comfortable coming to them. We also have the 24-hour crisis and tip line, which we have as a result of state legislation. And that is language. We have language line. And it really only takes about 3 minutes for us to hook up into any language. We haven't come across a language that we haven't been able to hook up with for interpretation for the trafficking crisis and tip line. The legislature also has provided enhanced trafficking criminal penalties. And we thank you, Minnesota State Senators, for these three things. These have enabled us to be very successful in helping human trafficking victims. We have, as I said, 15 free weekly legal trafficking screening clinics. 10 of those are a result of the legislation, the state legislation, and 5 of them are as a result of other grants that we have. And we, at those free screening clinics, which we, I think this is, well, I think I know I created it. It's our best practice method, and it's very effective in overcoming the barriers that people that speak other languages, have diverse religions, have diverse traditions, can overcome the barriers to get confidential, free legal advice without making reservations, making appointments. Most of them are walk-in clinics. So 10 of those are as a result of your efforts, and 5 are as a result of other funding. And I want to introduce some of the people that are the representatives of the organizations that we have those free legal clinics in. They're here. Okay, so I see Bihi Abdulrazak. You can stand. From Somali Education and Social Advocacy. Thank you, Bihi. And Tran Tro, and he is from Vietnamese Minnesotans Association, and that is in the, thank you, in the Hub Center. And if you've ever been to the Hub Center, you know that you have never seen such a multicultural arena in the state of Minnesota. Then we have Vi Ho from Vietnamese Social Services. And I saw Raj Chowdhury right here from SIWA. And I hope I'm not ignoring anyone else. Okay, so then we also have other organizations that we go around the country and actually the world speaking with. And one of them is here, and that's Elsa Batika from FAWN,
Philippine American Women's Network of Minnesota.
Thank you. These are our partners, and we have hundreds of them. And we have to have them because that is the only way that people are going to come to us. The other thing we do is we have very, very diverse attorneys. We have attorneys that speak 7, 8 different languages and have many different cultural backgrounds and religious backgrounds. And all of these things make a difference to a person who is really in trouble. If you are really in trouble, you want to talk in your own language. And our crisis line is, the person that answers our crisis line most of the time is Russian, so you will see that we get an awful lot of Russian victims in, because I'll show you the nationalities of our victims. Okay, so this is the nationality of the victims who have been reported to civil society. So you can see that we have the largest group is Russian because...
Ms. Miller, can you hang on a second? Members, you have that pie chart in your folder. It's here so you don't have to squint to see the numbers.
You can't squint. You have to squint to see it on the pie chart.
No. There's a larger one.
Oh.
There's a larger one in your folder. Oh. Do you all have that?
There. I still need my glasses.
In the black folder, this black folder.
Here it is.
All right. Now that we're all on the same page, Ms. Miller.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Senators. This is the people who have been reported as trafficked to civil society from April 1st, 2005, to March 31st, 2008. And you can see the large portion of Russian. And you can see a lot of Filipino and Somali and Vietnamese, Korean, Chinese, and a lot of people from Africa, the various countries in Africa. Many of them speak French, and so having a French attorney is very helpful. And you can see that we have to be very diverse. We have 15 different attorneys, and we try to match as best we can each victim that comes in with an attorney. And that's the way we get people to come forward. And then I want to show you a legislative map of Minnesota that maybe you haven't seen. This is from a few years back, but you can see this is the largest primary. Okay, I'm going to wait till you find it. It's
again, the large map is in your packets.
Okay. So we have, this is the largest primary home language other than English spoken in each school district. And we added the larger country names because the map is so small otherwise. The legend to the map is so small. So you can see way in the upper east north part of our country, the second language is Russian. This is of the primary school children. Now, this is as a result of we are very fortunate in Minnesota to have a great deal of diversity in our cultures. And we just need to realize that in order to serve people that are trafficked, we have to reach all these different people in the state of Minnesota. And I think this map really shows us how much diversity we need in order to serve those victims. We are serving, civil society serves the international human trafficked victims. And what we mean by that is people that are from other countries and they are here as a result of force, fraud, or coercion. And that is the federal definition. The state definition is broader than that.
So, Ms. Miller, yes. The earlier question that I asked Ms. Alwell is that in your information, do you distinguish between those who are brought in from their country of origin for the specific purposes of trafficking from those refugees who are currently living in Minnesota?
Yes, we do. We distinguish... And this pie chart here is of victims who are here in the United States from another country as a result of the force, fraud, and coercion. So they are not American citizens
or
refugees. They may be refugees, but they have been, they may be refugees, but they have been brought in as a result of force, fraud, and coercion. And I have actually in this packet three case studies of refugees. And this is where Behi Abdurazak has been so helpful. What is occurring in the Somali community is that there are bad people in that community, just like in every community. And what they are doing is bringing people in from, it would be Kenya or Tanzania, probably now the refugee camps there, saying that they are members of their family, and then they are not actually members of their family. They are bringing in young girls, and then they are being sold to older men or so-called uncles, and that is one form that we find. And then another form is when they're brought in, they're not part of the family, so they end up serving the family, doing labor trafficking, and they're brought in by force, fraud, or coercion.
Sure.
So that is a refugee who is trafficked. And every, so what we are distinguishing is the federal definition, which is they are here as a result of the force, fraud, and coercion. So they may not, they would not be a person from Chicago who comes to Minnesota to be a victim of sex trafficking.
And Ms. Miller, I see here under the language, it says in the little ovals where you have the different colors for the different language.
Yes.
Next to it is a parenthesis with a number inside it. What does that number represent, or what is?
That is, I believe, the percentage. The percentage of the primary school children that would be speaking that language. So in many cases, it's very low. But what this does for us is show the diversity of the people that we need to bring these victims in, because they will be among many times among these people.
Senator Lemmer, did you have a question?
Yes. Ms. Miller, looking at the pie chart.
Yes.
I'm noticing there's a lot of countries, primarily in Asia, a few from South America and a few from Africa, but there's certain continents that don't seem to have representation. Europe, maybe Indonesia, Malaysia, but I'm just wondering why is, have you run into any internationally trafficked victims from Europe?
I think we had one from England reported to us, but she never came in. But I think that when we talk about this to the international leaders, it's the countries of origin generally, and the countries of destination, and the countries of transit, and generally, when you're speaking in terms of international trafficked victims, they will be from a poorer country and going to a richer country. And all of Europe is generally a destination. The countries of Europe are generally destination countries, and the countries of origin and transportation are the poorer countries in Europe, such as Ukraine. And we do have several from Ukraine. I've also looked at the patterns of international trafficking in the world. And we all have heard of Moldova being one of the countries where there's not even any women left in the villages. They are mostly going to Turkey and Greece and some of the countries that Moldova has always had commercial trade with. And so there's patterns, there's certain patterns. So we don't have hundreds of women men from Moldova in our pie chart because they are mostly going to Turkey and Saudi Arabia to be in their traffic, being trafficked there.
Madam Chair,
Senator Lemire.
I don't know if the average Minnesota citizen is even aware of trafficking. It's almost like a hidden industry. But when you start talking of the percentages of this crime affecting one little country called Moldova, but the total saturation, as I've been told, of its influence on that country, at least maybe for the country of Moldova, it may even rival proportionately the slave trade of the 1700s.
Yes.
And it's like a hidden phenomenon that's happening around the world right now. And I think we probably, for the purposes of public policy formation, we probably need to understand that on a global perspective a little bit better. We kind of are looking at the symptoms in the state, beginning to get a little indication that, this thing called trafficking is here in Minnesota, and we get these percentages, and in and of itself, you see these 0.5% from Fiji. What does that represent? But you start putting it all into a bigger hole that you have here, and then think that this is just our little slice of Minnesota. You got 50 other states, and we're kind of tucked up here in the middle of the Midwest, and we may not be the destination state like a California or a Texas or a New York or East Coast, but it begins to give you a little different perspective once you start taking a giant step back to kind of view the proportionality of what really is going on in the world today. And we're just looking at the stuff that comes here. There's other trafficking that's going, let's say, in between all of these countries back and forth. Uh-huh. And probably much more aggressive and much more brutal than we ever suspect. So I don't know if there's anyone in the state that can give us a big picture worldwide of what's really going on. And is it, how big a problem is it really?
I think the latest, they all say trafficking victims don't line up to get counted, but... what the federal government is saying and the United Nations is saying is that there's 600 to 800,000 trafficked victims in the world, and 14,500 to 17,500 are brought into the United States each year. Those are the current...
Madam Chair,
Senator Lemire,
does human trafficking have anything to do with missing children?
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Senator Lemire, we have approximately 20 of our victims are children.
From this country?
No, they are here in Minnesota.
I see.
And they were trafficked from other countries mm-hmm. as a result of force, fraud, or coercion. And some came...
How many, Ms. Miller?
About 20 that we've helped over this period of time. And again, a large portion of them, because I have more knowledge of Somalia, people, refugees... from Somalia, because I was in Peace Corps there too. Anyway, I'll just give that as an example. Okay, Somalia has been without a government for 17 years. So birth certificates have not been issued. People don't know their birth dates. And then they go to a very chaotic situation in the refugee camps in Kenya and Tanzania. And then they're brought over as children, and they don't have birth certificates. Actually, the government gives them 1-1, January 1st, as their birth date, and then the year of their birth, perhaps. They guess at that. So you can see how there can be a lot of, if there's someone that wants to use that system, they can use that system to get someone over here that they can traffic. All of the children that are brought in by an adult, but many adults come in, are trafficked by themselves, is what we see. The children are many times in the refugee communities, but not all of them at all. They're a broad spectrum. There's mail order brides that are brought in, and their children, and actually the trafficker wants their children. And then those children are the ones that are the trafficked victim.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
In the presentation today, we kind of have begun to focus, it's easy to maybe get led to this, but it kind of gives the impression that when we talk of international trafficking, of course, being international would be people outside of the United States, and it's easy to indict or cause an image to indict a group of people from different countries, and that the citizens of the United States are somehow kind of excluded from being involved in this traffic. And I think it's important for us as a committee to remember that there's a market for this type of trafficking, and it doesn't mean that just because 12.3% of this traffic comes from Russia that it's necessarily going to a market only made up of Russian
immigrants.
Nationality. There is a market for it, and we haven't tiptoed into that. We've talked about where the victims come from, but will there be a discussion today of where the market is, and is it Americans that want, are they fueling this demand?
And Ms. Miller, do you have information about that on the, what's driving the demand or what the market looks like here? I know that when we get to the conversation about the Native women, I think there will be some discussion about that. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to talk a little bit about the using the opportunity of the two national conventions as an opportunity to talk about a situation. Not just because they're national conventions, but I think there are large conventions that happened all around the world. And I just came from the New Orleans, where the National Conference of State Legislatures took place. I think that those are some of the opportunities that also draw or incite some of the trafficking. So, Ms. Miller, if you have any specific information that could answer Senator Limmer's question, why don't we have you provide that? Mm-hmm. And then if you can sum up your presentation, we'd like to move on to the other two speakers.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the market is... we in Minnesota do have money, and as far as I can tell from the traffickers that we have, obviously we don't see the traffickers, we see the victims, and then they describe the traffickers. It comes from all walks of life, all walks of life in the state of Minnesota. And some of the factors that are increasing it exponentially are the internet, the ease of travel, worldwide travel, fact that Minnesota has a large border with Canada. It has a port. People come in both those entry points into an area that is very, it is not patrolled. And I'll give you a quick example. One client we have from Togo was trafficked, in other words, got a visa, money for a visa, and of course the traffickers did all this, waiting period, went to South Africa, another visa, attorney, fee, waiting period, then went to Australia, another visa, waiting period, lawyer, all involved in this trafficking, and went to London, and then from London to Canada, and then was driven over into Minnesota. So the worldwide network is there. And that's what some of the definition coercion is about. It's not only are the victims in danger here, but it's family, it's children, and it's elderly parents, grandparents that are back home that are also in danger from the traffickers. So there's that's one of the elements of coercion. Then just going forward, the federal funds we have are very, very, very restricted in terms of who we can provide the human trafficking services for. We have a variety, we have funds that cover it's medical, dental, mental health, ESL, vocational counseling, translation, transportation, food, housing, legal, and incidentals. But the number of the victims that the federal funds cover are extremely restricted as of March 20th. And so actually in the state of Minnesota, we've had 27 traffickers convicted, serving time, and the victims who have provided, most of the victims who have provided the evidence for the conviction of those traffickers who are in horrible danger, have all the needs of trafficking victims, can't be covered by the federal funding. And none of the children that we have can be covered under the federal funding. So that's why there was a report card on state action, and that's in your, some of the pages are here. This is a national report card, and we get a D on victim protection and assistance, and that is because because Minnesota doesn't have any victim services that the legislature has brought forth. What we have is outreach, and I don't think we should have been given a D because we have such fantastic outreach. Our legal clinics, 15 legal clinics a week, do provide the screening, but not the legal services for the victims. Fortunately, we have a lot of people here, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, who help us. Other sisters, Sister Renee does the ESL. We have many, many, many friends in this room. And together, also with the Violence Against Women Act, which covers men, women, and children, we are able to care for the victims. We have taken care of every victim that we have gotten in. But the federal funds aren't doing it. And so that's why what we want to do is we want to ask for continued funding of these screening clinics and the crisis line, which has been fantastic. And actually, the crisis line got in one of the stories that I put in your packet. And you'll read that, and you'll be shocked. So then we also want to ask for the state to fund some of the housing the ESL, vocational counseling, medical, dental, legal, etc.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. We have two more presenters, and I think that their information will be very informative. Members, I know that we're due to adjourn at 11:30, but I'm hoping that you all will be willing to stay until 11:45 so that we can have adequate opportunity to not only hear from the presenters, but to also ask questions to get the information. So our next speaker is Ms. Suzanne Kettlinger. I'm very glad that she was able to make it. I know that there were some difficulties with trying to get here today. She's the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. I know that this year the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center was instrumental in trying to get us to look at this issue with respect to Native women and girls who are being prostituted and trafficked off the reservation. And it's appropriate for us to talk about that because I think sometimes we forget that the in Indian country, we're dealing with a whole different nation, even though they're within the state of Minnesota. And so as we try to do this work, we have to think about Indian women and girls who are being trafficked off the reservations as really part of the international trafficking that's taking place here and the phenomenon that's taking place here. And I'm very glad that you both are here, and thank you for coming to present us with the information. So whichever one of you want to start.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members, and I wouldn't have missed this for the world, so thanks very much. I'm going to defer to my colleague, Nicole Matthews, who is the executive director of the Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, and let her start, and then I'll wrap it up.
Ms. Matthews, welcome.
Thank you very much. As Suzanne said, I hope I can get this close enough. My name is Nicole Matthews. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. We're a statewide tribal coalition located here in St. Paul and working with all 11 federally recognized tribes in Minnesota. We are currently doing research on trafficking, prostitution and trafficking of Native women in Minnesota, and we have just begun that research. There's several studies have, as you've heard today, we've heard a lot about international trafficking. Very little attention has been paid to domestic trafficking, and little to no attention has been brought to Native victims of trafficking. And so Suzanne, I know, has worked very hard to bring this issue to light, and we, for one, want to get some research because we really don't know the scope of the problem. So we want to know what's going on, for one. We've heard a lot of anecdotal information. We've heard anecdotal information about Duluth and Native women and girls being prostituted and trafficked on the ships in Duluth. We had a meeting in Fond du Lac in January, and there was a woman who said, we were talking about it, and she said, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, she goes, everybody talked about the parties on the ships and wanting to go to the parties on the ships, and what was really happening was they were calling them parties and they were trafficking the women off these ships. So we've heard these anecdotal stories for a really long time, and we're really excited to be able to find out what's really going on, and hopefully that will lead to an increase of culturally specific services for Native women in Minnesota, to which there is none for victims of trafficking or prostitution that are specific to Native women in Minnesota. In fact, we only have 5 tribal sexual assault programs in the state of Minnesota and 1 urban sexual assault program, the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center. So the services, culturally specific services to Native women, are very, very slim to none. Like I said, our research, we're working with Melissa Farley, who's a leading researcher on prostitution and has done research in 9 different countries. And so we are using some of her questionnaires, so we will be able to compare our data with data that has been collected in 9 countries. And we're very excited about that. We're also working, someone brought up the communication between tribes and in the state, and we're working very closely with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council to one, gain support from tribal leadership, and two, to keep them involved in what's going on, to make them aware of what's going on, and to work with them on how we can take the next step to really address these issues. I see a lot of further needs for, you know, emergency money for victims and for housing, you know, and some of the issues that, you know, up here that Linda Miller addressed, that, you know, the international victims of trafficking are in need of, are also the same for Native victims. Let's see. And one last thing I just wanted to point out, because I really want, we hear a lot about data, and it sometimes starts to feel less, not very personal to me, and I just want to make sure that everybody, you know, that there's real people that are being affected. And for Native women, we are the life givers of our communities, and we're held in very high regard. And this is really, you know, this is really hurting our communities. And for everybody to remember that these are real women and real girls, and to keep that woman's face when you're working, when I'm working, when everybody's doing their work and dealing with numbers and money and all of that, to remember that there's a face, that, you know, let there always be that face there.
Thank you. There was a handout that was included in your packet, and it gives a little bit of background as to the disproportionate rates of sexual assault against American Indian women. Amnesty International's report last year, Maze of Injustice, calls it a human rights violation. Indian women are raped 3 times as often as other women, and yet the Department of Justice says 70% of sexual assaults against Native women go unreported. So if we know it's 3 times as bad, but we don't know about 70% of them, we really have no idea how bad it is. When we talk about trafficking as a larger topic, I want to make sure I say we are not trying to distract from international traffic victims to try and drain resources from them. That is desperately needed, and those victims need those services. We want to add this to the dialogue because from a federal level, there has been no attention paid to the fact that domestic children and women, largely, are being sold, trafficked into sexual slavery. When we talk about sexual exploitation and sexual slavery, we're talking about prostitution, and I think we need to just accept that. There's a tendency, I think, in some circles to identify prostitutes as women who have chosen this as a profession, and I'm here to say that that's a misconception. Prostitution, and Vanita, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to borrow your phrase. This is not the world's oldest profession, it is the world's oldest oppression. The average age of entry into prostitution is 12. What 12-year-old wakes up in the morning and says, this is my career choice, I want to be raped and brutalized by strangers every day of my life. And then somehow when she's 18, she's made a choice to be a prostitute. What we want to do is say, these are women who have been prostituted, intentionally using the verb, because 90% of women who are in prostitution have a history of sexual violence, sexual abuse, domestic violence. There's a gender violence component and a multiple trauma component that the vast majority of these women share. It makes them vulnerable. If you look at the conditions that lead to vulnerability to predators in the internationally trafficked community, most of those conditions are present on our U.S. reservations here in Minnesota and all over the country. We're also seeing high rates of suspected trafficking here in the urban area. So it's not just girls being brought down off the reservations to Duluth or to the Twin Cities, but they are Native girls who are living here in the Twin Cities who are being trafficked into prostitution. Senator Limmer, you asked a question about the market. This is a market-driven enterprise. If men didn't want to buy these young women, we wouldn't have a supply. It's a supply and demand market. And disproportionately in the state of Minnesota and nationally, domestically trafficked victims are women of color. They're Native American, they're African American, they're Latinas, they are minority women, and this is a population that oftentimes doesn't get enough attention. When we hear stories of blue-eyed blonde girls being victimized, we pay a lot of attention. We need to pay attention to all of these victims. One does not carry more weight than the other. We need to know that these are our children. These are American citizens, and right now there are no resources to address this problem. So we consider this to be a statewide public health and public safety issue. And when we talk about the issue of domestic trafficking of American Indian girls and women, a lot of times people say, well, we don't have any good information. Nicole talked about our efforts to gather some accurate data. We're beginning that. We're doing it in the urban area, and Nicole's organization is doing it statewide. We hope by the end of the year to have some pilot data that tells us some rough percentages about the numbers of victims that we're seeing in social services in the metro area and statewide. But if we consider that in 2005, the Department of Health said the state spent $8 billion on sexual violence, and the vast majority of that money was spent on predators. And if we think about a young girl who's 13, who's victimized in this way, she's going to become a mother. She doesn't have options about birth control. So she's going to have children. What happens to those children? The state's going to take them away. She'll lose those children to the child protection system. The cost of long-term foster care, very high. The outcomes for children, particularly Indian children, in long-term foster care, very poor. These kids are more likely to be homeless, more likely to drop out of school, more likely to join gangs. So the long-term costs of not addressing this at an early stage is much higher than anyone really knows. There are partnerships in place, and we're beginning to get a handle on how we need to address this, and it's very important that we work cross-sector in collaboration. Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, my organization, the Indian Women's Resource Center, the Division of Indian Work in Minneapolis are working with the Minneapolis Police Department and Hennepin County Probation. We're now beginning to develop a relationship with the city attorney in Minneapolis. I just came from that meeting here, Hennepin County Bench. And Faye Green Benson is now interested in working with us on trying to develop early interventions for young Native girls who are on the streets. For a runaway, you asked about missing children. Absolutely. Native girls, if you go to any reservation and go to their human services office, look at the posters. 15-year-old girl gone missing. 13-year-old girl, we haven't seen her in 6 weeks. One of the tribal chairs asked me after a presentation, do you think these girls have been trafficked? It's a good possibility. If one of those girls runs away and ends up on the streets of Minneapolis, she has an average of 36 hours before she's approached by a pimp or a John and solicited for sex. Now, if you're a kid, and you don't have any money, and it's raining, and it's cold, and you don't have any food, and you don't have a place to stay, and some guy who doesn't look too bad says, well, you can come home with me. So she begins to trade sex for food, or sex for shelter, or sex for a ride. She may have an addiction. That may be why she's vulnerable, because she already has some sort of chemical or alcohol addiction. Maybe she's going to trade sex for drugs. So that begins, and what we're seeing as we're beginning to interview these young girls is they don't identify that as prostitution. They don't identify that they have been victimized. And you heard Linda Miller talk earlier about the fact that these girls are not lining up to say, I was a victim of a federal crime. Because if we understand the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, then any juvenile used in sexual exploitation is a victim of a federal crime, and it's not being prosecuted. We need to change that. These are children. They're 13 years old. They're 11 years old. They're 16 years old. They deserve to be going to school, having a safe place to live, and not being brutally raped every single day of their lives. So we have a huge amount of work to do, but I do see a lot of hope, and I see a possibility for Minnesota to take the lead on a national initiative, working with the tribes. As Nicole mentioned, we have the support of the tribal leaders. We're working with local law enforcement. We're beginning to do some regional organizing in Duluth. I'll be up in Bemidji later this week, and we're going to start talking about how we can work in that area as well. We have law enforcement. We have the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Native-specific social service agencies, and the tribes all saying, okay, what do we do about this? Well, the first thing we need to do is get some good data. We need to understand the scope of the problem. We need to know who's being trafficked, how are they being trafficked, and who's doing the trafficking. Again, we have anecdotal evidence, and we have some very good anecdotal evidence and an accumulating pile of anecdotal evidence, but we have no hard data, and we do need to get that because currently, you probably know this, in the federal government, the William Wilberforce Reauthorization Act is pending, and that's the reauthorization for the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, and it does, in fact, offer some funding for domestically trafficked victims. However, it does that at the expense of the internationally trafficked victims. We don't want to see that happen, but we're waiting to see what Wilberforce looks like when it comes through. We believe that if we can present some strong statistics that are gathered in a culturally appropriate way, because when you have the right person asking the right questions of a victim, you're going to get better information. We think that we can present that information to our federally elected representatives and build a strong case for a major infusion of federal resources into the state of Minnesota to address this particular population. American Indian children are disproportionately on the streets of South Minneapolis. American Indian women are disproportionately arrested for prostitution in South Minneapolis. In the third precinct, my little patch of paradise, 93% of all the arrests for prostitution in the state take place. That's a statistic I have from Minneapolis Police Department. 93% of all prostitution arrests in the state in the third precinct of Minneapolis, and a disproportionate number of them are young Native women. We have begun to develop an outreach program to work with these Native women in partnership with the police department, and my staff is now starting to do outreach to the workhouse because we believe we'll hear some stories from these women that will help us better understand how it was that they came to be trafficked into prostitution. So we have this layer of trafficking that we need to look at, but I really ask you to consider how we look at our prostitution laws in the state of Minnesota. Last year, I came to the legislature and I asked for, with Nicole's organization and the Division of Indian Work, we sought an appropriations of $175,000 to conduct culturally based research. There wasn't any money, so we didn't get it. But we did have a hearing in the House Public Safety Finance Committee. And, well, we were told there's no money. And so Representative Clark said, well, what about the Johns Fund? Maybe there's some money in the Johns Fund. We said, great, if that money is not already allocated for Breaking Free or Pride or one of the other excellent organizations that are serving these women, we'd love to have those resources. So we did a little research into that, and there was $100 in the Johns Fund. Are we not arresting these guys? Are we not prosecuting these guys? So I asked Susan Siegel that question this morning at the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and she said, first-time offenders are given a diversionary program. And then we don't see them a second time. Either they're getting smart and not getting picked up, or they learn their lesson. Now, if they go to Breaking Free's John School, they will often learn their lesson. But we need to start holding these guys accountable. We also see opportunity for our organizations to work collaboratively with law enforcement and prosecutors to build prosecutable cases. If my staff has a young woman that they have built a trust relationship with in their office, and she says, I don't want this guy to be able to do this to anyone else, we can help. We can start gathering some of the information that will build corroborating evidence so that the focus is now taken off of her and put onto the pimp or the John or whoever it is that she wants to provide information about. So we see our role as just a piece of a bigger picture that needs to start really. We need to get all the pieces of this jigsaw puzzle put together on the table. I think right now we've got our corner pieces and some of our border put together. We've got to get that middle stuff with all those rocks from Lake Superior.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. Any questions for Ms. Matthews, Ms. Kepling, Senator Olson, and then Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Keplinger. I really look forward to seeing you up in Bemidji in a couple days, and thanks for the invitation to that as well. I like what you said about recognizing that women in these situations are almost always victims. I'd say they're always victims, but they're often not given a choice. Their circumstances are bringing them in, and yet we don't. We kind of by society view them as the almost like looking at it from a moral perspective, right, as though they're the fallen women and everyone else is a victim of them. And I really appreciate what you're saying about changing society's view of that. I think that will also help young women to be more willing to come forward. But one thing you didn't mention that I wonder if there's any focus on is the role of gangs in this whole picture, because it seems to me from what I'm hearing, again, anecdotally, in northern Minnesota at least, that the gangs are a big part of what's making this happen. And if we could deal with some of the gang problems, we could that's kind of more close to the source of the problem.
Ms. Keplinger.
Yeah, we know the gangs are involved. We just don't know exactly who or to what extent. We suspect that there's probably some Native mob involvement. We also suspect Sereno's 13s are involved with this. But we also think there's probably some enterprising entrepreneurs out there who are just individuals or families that operate together. Example, one of my staff got a call from her daughter not too long ago who was standing on the corner of 26th and Cedar in South Minneapolis, and her daughter said, Mom, there's two black guys trying to shove these two Indian girls into a car. And she was like, call the police, don't call your mother. But that was an example of, she was probably seeing, these two young women were probably trying to abduct these women for the use of forcing them into prostitution. It happened to be that there are two African-American guys, but we also hear stories of men of all races doing this. So that's part of the research that we need to do, is we don't have good information about the role of the gangs. We do know on an international level that trafficking is the second most profitable criminal enterprise after drug trafficking. It's tied with arms trafficking for the most lucrative criminal enterprise. So we know that there's a correlation between drug trafficking and human trafficking as well. I don't know if you have anything to add.
We do have questions. In addition to Melissa Farley's questionnaires, we have created our own culturally specific questionnaire with some further details, and we do ask if there was gang involvement or any sort of like organized crime, gang, not necessarily gang, could be family member, asking who is trafficking them, how they got into it, and we're asking the race of the trafficker, and who most often purchases either the victim or who they see most often that is purchasing Native women.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, if you would indulge us, I think there's someone in the audience who's done a lot of research on this issue who might be able to add to this discussion. There she is.
Okay. Yes, please come to state very quickly because I know we have one more speaker, and as it is, we're running out of time. So,
no problem.
Thank you.
Sure. My name's Jennifer Blank. I actually did research on traffickers. I interviewed traffickers in London in 2003. And the men there, a lot of it started as a family business. They were trafficking drugs, guns, refugees to begin with. They moved over to trafficking humans because it was a lot more lucrative. It's a low-risk, high-profit crime. A lot of the times, they're obviously people are seen as commodities and sold as commodities rather than people. It's a lot easier to keep a person quiet if they're caught by the police by saying, you're my girlfriend or you're my cousin, whereas if you're caught with drugs, you're caught with drugs. So a lot of the times, gangs are involved as well. The Japanese Yakuza, Asian triads, Russian mafia are very, very highly involved in this as well. It's run very efficiently. There's usually about four people involved. There's a pimp, if it's sex trafficking. There's a recruiter, a middleman, and they just all work together. And it works very, very smoothly. And a lot of the times, it's the same people that are trafficking drugs and guns. They move over to that as well. It's all kind of combined together. And there's an estimated 27 million people enslaved throughout the world, whether it's through trafficking or through domestic servitude, brick making, what have you, child camel jockeys, they're all part of the same slavery background. And I guess that's all. If there's any more questions that you all have, though, I do have actual data on it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Can I also state, this is not only an urban issue. This is there is a very organized network in the rural areas of Minnesota that we, again, it's anecdotal. We don't really have numbers right now, but we have heard a lot of anecdotal information of a lot of organization that's happening in the rural communities that are trafficking women.
Very good. Senator Lummer?
I'll pass.
Okay. Well, thank you both very much, and it certainly was an educational perspective. Thank you. And so speaking of domestic being a market-driven effort, Ms. Carla Ferrucci is going to come and talk to us a little bit using the two big conventions. That's really kind of the anchor for the conversation. But, you know, I have to tell you, just last week in New Orleans, I went to a couple of clubs, and I saw some young women with some men who could be their father, but they didn't look like them. And the girls didn't look like they were having a good time because they weren't dancing. So I was particularly, because of our conversation and anticipating this, I was really paying attention to the crowd at the bars and the clubs on Bourbon Street. And I was shocked by the, and my very unsophisticated estimate, but I sensed that I kind of snagged, I could see the pattern, and it was kind of nauseous to me. So thank you for being here, and please share with us your information.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I appreciate you staying long to hear this. My name is Carla Ferrucci, and I'm the Director of Public Policy and Prevention at the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and I'm actually here as a spokesperson for a collaborative that came together during the legislative session, actually. So you should be receiving a packet. I apologize for getting it to you so late. But this is an example of a campaign that we have launched to address the potential for increase in prostitution and sex trafficking, and that's the language we're using for national conventions that come into town, specialty shows, expositions, conferences, and to really look at a public and private partnership to address the primary prevention of sexual exploitation. So I'll just briefly talk about that during the legislative session and working on with some of our member programs on their trafficking efforts here, I had heard from quite a few victim service agencies and other concerned citizens about what was going to happen during both the Democratic and Republican national conventions in terms of women being trafficked in and increase in prostitution. What was that a priority? And it became sort of a critical mass where there were so many different people saying that they wanted to do something and wanted to look at the issue. And in talking with some folks at the health department and looking at a public health response, we said, is there a way that we can bring a group together to actually develop an infrastructure? So not just for these conventions, but a process by which we can always respond to this particular nexus of conferences, conventions, and this being seen almost as a perk of being out of town. Now, it's going to seem a little disorganized because this has never been done before. We did some research. We tried. We found an organization in Colorado that was also working on this. Previous conventions, presidential endorsing conventions, did not have this sort of organizing effort in companion with what was happening in those cities. So New York and Boston in the last endorsing conventions did not have a campaign to address the increase in prostitution and sex trafficking. The only places that we have found that there's been a campaign has been in relation to the World Cup in Germany and other countries. As the World Cup moves, there's been an effort to address the increase in prostitution and sex trafficking. We also know that Vancouver has been discussing, and the mayor of Vancouver has been supportive of allowing prostitution to be legal during the Winter Olympic Games, and that there's been advocates coming together to address that issue. So we've been hearing from a lot of folks, and the media has been hearing about this effort. You know, is this really true? Is this going to happen? This is the first time in the states that we've tried to do something like this that we know of. So we're hoping that we can have some evaluation measures or some things to report once we're done about the rise in prostitution and sex trafficking. So I'm just going to, you can see on this sheet who all of the collaborating partners are in Minnesota. We're still trying to get all of the folks that are part of the Colorado Collaborative. They are actually currently working on printing materials for the Democratic Convention because it happens at the end of August, and so they're in a rush to get their materials printed. When this group came together, we tried to say, what is it that we can do? What can we possibly do? And you folks astutely mentioned that, you know, the general public really doesn't know what trafficking is and has misconceptions about what prostitution is. And by our state task force definition, they're really the same thing. So this group said, we really need to personalize the harm. That this, if you know that the average age of entry into prostitution is 12, then we know that this is that these are victims and they need services, that when they are recruited at 12 and are in the life, become drug addicted, are abused, and need services, that we need to hold offenders accountable, and that we need to stop the demand. And so what's the prevention work that we can do to stop the exploitation before it starts? So this is really, we met in March. We took a very long time to get us all to agree on a message. Our message really is buying sex stops here, and we're going to do that by raising awareness, supporting safety and accountability for perpetrators, and by engaging both delegates and the businesses that come to Minnesota and Colorado in joining us in stopping the demand. We were happy to hear that Senator McCain has a commitment to working on trafficking issues. Our dream would be that he would meet with us or his campaign would meet with us to talk to us about what that could look like should he win the election. Our efforts really are to look at what policies can we influence, how do we support the services in the Twin Cities and Bloomington during the convention and after, and what are the individual education messages or awareness pieces that we can do. So, in the short term for the DNC, and RNC. We will be developing awareness materials in conjunction with Martin Williams Ad Agency and the Not for Sale campaign. We'll be working with the Department of Public Safety in partnership to do some sort of awareness event or some sort of media. We're still kind of in the works right now and thinking about what that's going to look like. We have service providers meeting with law enforcement and shelter providers and other victim service agencies to ensure that there are services available to victims. And we're really hoping to get the message out there about what people can do to be proactive. Not saying you're going to come here and do this, but saying if you know that this is what's happening, that girls at the age of 12 are being recruited, then we want you to join us in stopping this by obviously not engaging in the behavior, but also going back and being advocates and joining other advocates and raising awareness about what this means. The second page, this page is a talking point sheet that we developed, and this really was to empower anyone to be able to talk about this issue. So what you'll find is for every piece that we're trying to raise awareness, we have actual statistics to back up what we're talking about. One of the things that folks need to think about in terms of accountability, the recent incident at Valley Fair, two of those men that were arrested for that crime against the father had just recently been busted in a prostitution sting. We have heard from some folks that do advocacy work in the community that some of those people were in the Evans family, that were part of the Evans family, which in Minnesota many years ago was a high-profile case of domestic prostitution. So we know that this this crime happens to both the victims, women who are used in prostitution, and they're harming, purchasers and pimps are harming women and girls who aren't formally involved in prostitution. Finally, there's an. I just gave you a bunch of information, advice, you know, things that you can do as policymakers and leaders. We responded to a Star Tribune article saying that Minneapolis was going to show its naughty side during the convention, and so I just we worked on it as a group. I provided you the letter to the editor that didn't get printed in the Star Tribune, but it's a way to see that we were trying to address the. Some of the media stories that are coming out almost promoting, you know, the naughty or dark sides of the Twin Cities. And then I also provided you with this just got emailed to me this morning, but the mayor of Atlanta and the state of Georgia is really taking a lead in addressing child prostitution. And I, you know, if we're doing this community effort and it's kind of a groundbreaking thing, it would be great for you all as leaders in Minnesota to think about ways that we can change some policies and practices at a state level and show a state commitment that this behavior won't be tolerated, both international sex trafficking and labor trafficking and domestic sexual exploitation. And then some other articles about efforts to legalize prostitution to accommodate the increase in visitors to some of these international events. And I know that we're pressed for time. I have more information. You can always call me. You know, look forward to working with you this coming session to making some important changes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Excellent.
That was very well done. Thank you so much. And thank you all so much for being here. I know that we could be here for a long time. There are many, many experts in the audience. I don't think that this is the end. I think this is merely the beginning of this conversation as we move through the interim, through to the upcoming legislative session in the years to come. And we look forward to partnering with all of you to educate us on what we can do on this issue. So thank you all very much for coming. And members, thank you for making the time to be here. And Senator Pappas, thank you for joining our committee. The Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.